This is Corporate Watchdog Radio. Welcome to Corporate Watchdog Radio, coming to you twice monthly with interviews and news on corporate social responsibility and socially responsible finance. I'm Sanford Lewis.
And I'm Bill Bowie. Today we have in the studios Dan Viederman, who is the executive director of Verite, an Amherst, Massachusetts-based global nonprofit social monitoring, training, and research organization. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, Bill.
And for people might not quite understand what it is that such an organization does. So why don't we start out with just explaining what exactly it is that Verite does?
Sure. It is a bit embedded in the deep dark details of the global economy and globalization and the ways in which companies source these days. But basically, what we do is we help companies by going into factories and identifying the labor conditions and the environmental conditions that they face in those factories. So when an apparel manufacturing brand like Gap, for example, sources in China or Bangladesh or Latin America somewhere, it's generally working with factories that it does not own, but rather that it contracts with. And yet as Gap, it recognizes that it has some risk based on the labor conditions that would be found in those factories. And so it wants to know what's really going on. It's often difficult for the company itself to gather that information, and so in many cases they hire an independent research organization or investigative body like us to go on their behalf into the factories to talk to workers and to talk to management, to look at the records and see what's going on in the factory.
So your status of independence and third party is an important aspect of your ability to gather the information.
It's an important part of our ability, particularly to be able to credibly represent the information to the company and for the company, therefore, to be able to talk to its stakeholders about having gotten an accurate picture. So the company is also using its own internal sources to get information. It has staff overseas in China or Bangladesh or Latin America, wherever. But it may not believe that those folks are getting all the information that they could. They may not have the time and effort to look into conditions in as much detail as they might like, particularly if the company has reason to believe that conditions are really problematic in some ways. And they may also want that additional layer of credibility and verifiability from having a third-party group come in.
And what is it that your staff does on the ground?
Good question. We do several things. And as you mentioned, we do social monitoring, but we'll also do training and research to follow up. But let me take the social monitoring part first. We'll basically go in, usually unannounced, to a factory and do four things. We'll interview the factory management and talk to them using a long interview tool that we have that goes over a whole range of questions about labor conditions, everything from child labor, forced labor, wages and hours, freedom of association. We'll then look at records, factory records, payroll records, and health and safety records, and records of the factory clinic, for example, to see what kind of health and safety problems there might have been, what kind of accidents there might have been, what kind of injuries. We will then do a walkthrough. We'll look around and see whether fire extinguishers are in the places they ought to be, whether exit doors are blocked, whether the sort of basic OSHA standards of health and safety are adhered to. But then most importantly, and this is where we distinguish ourselves, I think, from others, we will talk to workers, and we'll talk to workers in a way that they can feel some confidence that they're not going to be exposed to the management or ultimately to the brand if they give information that is in some ways places the factory in a negative light. So we'll talk to workers off-site generally in places where they feel comfortable, be it in their dorm or at the cafe locally, and hope to gather information that they would be unwilling to share otherwise.
Okay. And when you say we, I'm assuming that isn't you all of the time. Who is we doing the gathering?
It's infrequently me. I must say I've been on three factory audits in the territory of Macau, which was a fascinating experience. But no, we work through a global network of regional offices and partner NGOs, non-governmental organizations around the world. So we have upwards of 30 to 40 people who work for us on a very regular basis, and then additionally probably another several hundred people who work for us on an occasional basis. Going into the factories themselves, there are always people of the local culture with local language skills, or relevant language skills, I should say, folks who have a background in social development or social compliance or some sort of investigation research. We actually have a lot of journalists working for us around the world. And so it's always local folks who are going to the factories directly and gathering the information, then reporting it back to us in Amherst, Massachusetts, and we feed that onto the company itself.
Okay, and where is this taking place? Globally, you say, what specific countries and regions?
We have worked over the 11 years that we've been around in over 60 countries and territories. I checked before I came over and found that last year we did factory monitoring visits in 30 countries and territories. But I should say that of the several hundred that we did, probably a third of the factory investigations took place in China. So China is a big focus for us, just as it's a big focus for anybody who's in the global manufacturing world these days. We did a fair amount of work in India as well, not surprisingly. By virtue of a particular program that we got involved in several years ago, we also do a lot of work in Saipan, which was the substance of a class action lawsuit and a settlement. And as part of the settlement related to labor conditions in Saipan, we are the monitor. And so we do a fair amount of work in Saipan. And aside from that, it varies quite a lot in Southeast Asia, Central America, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. We work in the places where the labels on your clothes say the clothes came from, for the most part.
That Saipan issue was a pretty big issue in the news. How is it that you were chosen as the organization to do the monitoring?
I don't know exactly how we were chosen. It was a bit of a confused process. I should say that I think one of the reasons we were chosen was that we have a relatively good reputation as a credible organization to feed information. And so we are technically the monitor on the plaintiff's side. There is also another monitoring organization operating in Saipan under the settlement as well, and they share equally with us the number of audits, and they were chosen by the defendant's side, that is the settling company's side, so the brands that had settled the lawsuit and as part of the settling agreed to monitoring in the factories in Saipan. So there's actually two of us at work. We are on the plaintiff's side, and I think we're chosen in some ways because we have an NGO and a mission-focused background, and therefore we thought that we could do a pretty good job representing workers' interests.
Well, that starts to get to the kind of issue that I'm wondering about, which, you know, as a lawyer, I've dealt with a lot of independent monitoring situations in local communities, and the question of who pays for the monitoring and how money influences the process is of great interest to me. Who pays? It sounds like sometimes maybe what? Just tell us who pays. And how does that affect the process? How do you maintain independence?
It's a great question, and it's one that I think is floating around in a lot of the discussions that we have with clients and brands and activists and others. Excuse me. In most of the work that we do, and I should say in almost all of the instances where we're doing factory monitoring, it's the brands themselves that are paying. And I know that that raises red flags for some. I would say, to the contrary, that in fact it is the brands that should be paying for that work. It's their supply chains. They're the ones who need to prove, either for their own internal business reasons or for in terms of legal compliance, that they are acting in a way in accordance with their stated code of conduct or with the law. So for me, while I understand that the questions are often raised and are in many ways quite legitimate, I would hope that the discussion soon turns away from the question of who pays to the question of what is the outcome as a result of the work that is done. And I think that that helps answer the second part of your question, which is how do we maintain independence. We're transparent about the work that we do in terms of process. We are generally not transparent about the work that we do as it applies to the companies. That is, that the reports we'll do from a factory visit will go confidentially to the company for their action. We encourage companies to resolve the problems that they find or that we identify through the work that we do in their factories, but it's not really an area of responsibility to do that. Having said that, I think ultimately the ways in which external observers or stakeholders should determine whether or not an investigation or some sort of corporate effort is legitimate, there's a couple of conditions, I would say. First of all, what really was done on the ground. We're happy to tell you exactly what steps we take and share with you the tool that we use and share with you the process that we undertake and share with you the amount of time that it takes us to do this work and allow you to judge whether or not you think that the outcome is a legitimate outcome based on that amount of information, that amount of effort. This leads to the question of standards, and in many ways there are no standards that apply to monitoring in general. And that unfortunately allows a sort of general level of skepticism to exist about the monitoring effort. So in the absence of sort of a publicly recognized or accepted standard, what we're offering is our own kind of internal standard to the public and saying, you know, this is what we're doing, this is why we believe it's independent, you know, you be the judge, you tell us whether you think it's reasonable or not. The second piece, well, there's other pieces. I would say also as an organization, as a mission-driven organization and as a nonprofit organization, you should, I think it's legitimate to ask that you would be more predisposed towards the effectiveness and the independence of the work that we do based on the type of people that we've attracted. It's not a business. It's not the folks that we have involved are not in it for their own personal profit. Not to say that, you know, you should say, oh, well, Dan really cares about something and therefore I should trust that the work he's doing is good. Not at all. But it's not an unrelated issue as well. And I think as an NGO, we have an orientation towards solutions and towards providing good quality information that may not exist in the fee-for-service world.
What comes to mind immediately next is, so what if you're basically hired as an independent consultant to companies, what actually makes you a nonprofit? How do you maintain an NGO status rather than being a consulting firm?
We like many nonprofits, get fee-for-service funding and fee-for-service support, so that's not unusual in the nonprofit world. We also raise money individually and from individual donors, and we also raise foundation funds. And those are some of the elements that that one could say we benefit from as a nonprofit, but in fact that allow us to maintain our independence and allow us to maintain a sort of issue-oriented focus that we think adds to the quality and the depth of the work that we're doing in the factory specifically. So, for example, we've had foundation funds arrayed against the problem of foreign contract workers, essentially migrant workers in the Middle East and in East Asia, that is poor folks or folks from poorer countries in Southeast Asia who go elsewhere to work and face a pretty wide range of exploitative conditions and inequitable laws and inequitable status in countries. I raise this as an example of the type of work that we're likely to do as a result of seeing the problem of inequitable status and poor conditions faced by foreign contract workers in however many of the factories that we've looked in over the course of 10 years, and said, let's take a look at that in a more targeted way, in a more cross-cutting way, and in particular to start to look at the question of solutions. So not just to investigate the problem, and this brings me back to another important point, I think, in the context of why should we be trusted. What we're about is identifying ways to move forward to solve problems. And I think the debate that we have around monitoring, the debate that we have about independence, all too often focuses on the types of activities that people undertake. We'd be perfectly happy if you'd look at the work that we do and identify whether it's legitimate on the basis of what kind of impact it has ultimately on the lives of workers and on the conditions in the factories. And I think that's a much more broadly the type of analysis that we ought to be applying to the companies as well. It's too easy in a complicated realm like social monitoring to accept what many companies say, which is, hey, don't worry about our labor conditions, we're monitoring them. In fact, monitoring, as we know, is just a form of gathering information, and it's a far cry from solving the problems that you find. And I think that an organization like ours is much more willing to be judged on the basis of how our information is used, how we present it to companies, and how we move towards solutions, rather than simply as an organization that is looking at conditions in factories and just writing reports about them.
So do you have any metrics or ways of measuring improvement, or is that within your purview?
Absolutely. Our auditing is done against a corporate code of conduct, which is based on the 8 fundamental International Labor Organization conventions. That is the sort of basic agreements internationally of what labor conditions ought to be. An example is that, you know, no one under the age of 15 should be working. If we, in an audit, find that there are people in the factory who are under 15 working, essentially finding child labor, the measurement of the impact in that auditing effort should be in whether or not that problem is resolved. Are there any children continuing to work there the next time an auditor, be it us or someone else, goes in? So the metrics are really presented by the company codes of conduct and the company commitments to making a change at the factory and to ridding, so-called ridding their supply chain of these non-compliant or illegal manifestations of poor working conditions.
You're listening to Dan Viederman right now, and we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Corporate Watchdog Radio. We're back here on Corporate Watchdog Radio with Dan Viederman, who is the executive director of Verité out of Amherst, Massachusetts. And we've been talking about Verité's social monitoring programs. And you talked about sort of the external, how the results of your work is recognized externally. So I'm wondering, you know, how does somebody who is buying an article from The Gap or a pair of New Balance shoes, how are they going to be, how are they going to recognize the work that you've done, and how is it going to improve their product, so to speak?
This is where it can get very wonky very quickly, I think, because the work that we do is often not visible in any easy way to the consumer. And if it is, then the consumers spend a fair amount of time really trying to get to understand this stuff. I would say that the one thing that consumers ought to be looking at most seriously is to what level does the company itself recognize that it has problems and make some statements about how it's going to solve the problems. So the Gap is a great example because they were, I think, quite rightfully recognized for issuing one of the first corporate social responsibility reports that talked openly and honestly about the sorts of problems that they found, and they really tried very hard and spent, I know, a lot of effort on trying to quantify the problems that they found and set themselves some very strict standards as to how they wanted to try to resolve them. And I think it's that kind of transparency, particularly underpinned by an admission of a problem, a presumption of a problem, that really makes the fundamental difference.
And that set precedent. I mean, Nike and Levi Strauss followed suit by doing things like publishing all of their factories or admitting that there are problems. I know that Verité has worked with The Gap. So you know, where do you fit into that? I know you can't talk in too much detail, but what is it? What kinds of things are you doing with The Gap?
Sure, and I can talk about The Gap as an instance, as a client as well, in particular because they did talk about it in their corporate social responsibility report. So it's a convenient example to use. They hired us to do what we call a program assessment, which was essentially an effort to look at the information they were already gathering about their labor conditions around the world and, in a sense, compare it to the information that we were able to gather in the same factories. So, in a sense, to do a bit of a checkup on their internal structures and processes by which we would be able to identify what they do well and what we might be able to help them to do better. And so, in our interaction with them, I think the most positive aspect of it was that they were really looking explicitly for assistance in improving the process that they undertook, and then they were willing to talk about it. And I think that's exactly what we as consumers ought to be looking for. At least it gives me some comfort that the company is dealing with these issues realistically and honestly, internally. And you mentioned, as the last part of your question, Bill, to what extent this has an impact on the product that the consumer is ultimately buying. Well, it's very difficult to draw a straight line between labor conditions and the quality of a product, or between labor conditions and the quality of investment if you're looking to buy Gap stock. But we do know anecdotally that factories where conditions are better produce better quality goods. And if a factory is producing better quality goods, then there's going to be a less financial stress within the supply chain of that company or of that brand. So if Gap is investing in companies where it creates longer-term relationships and it has invested in better labor conditions as well, it's okay to presume that as conditions improve, so should some measure of the quality of the product. So should some measure, so should decrease some measure of the sort of the stress in the relationship between Gap and its supplier, all of which should speak to, who knows, better financial performance and certainly maybe better quality in the product as well. So I'm not trying to overstate, I want to be careful not to overstate that case because it's not one that's well proven at all, but it is anecdotally accepted in the industry, and I think it's a reasonable one to try and bring up.
And certainly from an investment perspective, lowering risk. So if they're, you know, if they are trying to identify where problems that might become legal problems, where those exist, then they are reducing their risk, which, you know, has an impact from an investment perspective.
Not only reducing from a legal risk perspective, but also if a strategic supplier of a particular product or particular good has the supply interrupted to the brand because of some sort of labor problem. If there's child labor in the factory and the company, the brand has to exit that factory. Well, then that's if it's a strategic good, in fact, then it's a supply problem for the company itself.
You know, listening to this, and I realize we're running out of time and we won't have much more time to talk about this now. Maybe we'll have you back another time to talk about it more. But I'm realizing on this question of independence that it's a very different question if you're evaluating contractors for a company where they want to know the real deal that's going on in Southeast Asia, say, versus if you were evaluating plants within a company's own operations where they would potentially, you know, want the most softball type of analysis. And I've seen that in the United States so-called independent evaluations, which is why this is such a red flag for me. But it's been very interesting hearing about this, and I'm looking forward to learning more about what you do. We should definitely have you back on.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Thank you, Dan, for joining us. This is Dan Viederman that we've been speaking with, who is the executive director of Verite, which is an Amherst, Massachusetts-based non-governmental organization that does social monitoring. And you're listening to Corporate Watchdog Radio. Check in on some of the stories that we've been following in past editions of Corporate Watchdog Radio. First up, you know, stuff has been really happening recently. Sanford, tell us what's going on with DuPont in the last week or so.
Yes, 2 weeks ago, we had a whistleblower from DuPont, Glenn Evers, on our show talking about the issues related to the chemical PFOA. And quite a lot has happened in the last couple of weeks. It's really amazing. The EPA announced that they were pressuring 8 companies to reduce the presence of PFOA in products. Unfortunately, they're giving them a very long timeline, I think 10 years, to eliminate the use of these toxic chemicals in products. And just a couple days ago, an EPA advisory group declared a majority of the members declared that PFOA is a likely carcinogen. So both of these things have happened, and it's come into the news in the Wall Street Journal that McDonald's has announced that they are switching out of PFOA containing materials in paper wrappers. So all of that is happening. This is a fast-moving issue. There's going to be more on it, I think.
Is this because Corporate Watchdog Radio covered it, do you think?
It is. It attests to the incredible power of Corporate Watchdog Radio, as well as the group I work with, DuPont Shareholders for Fair Value.
And you should probably explain a little bit about what that group does, since you have a...
It's a group of shareholders that are very concerned about the impact of these issues on the bottom line at DuPont.
You know, just today, I got a press release on another story that we just covered recently. A few weeks ago, we had Cristobal Bonifaz speaking with us by the phone. He's a local resident about the lawsuit that he has filed in 1993. So about a dozen years ago, about Chevron, actually at that time, Texaco, that was operating in Ecuador for a number of years in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, up through early 1990s. And just today, I got a press release from Amazon Watch, which is a non-governmental organization that looks at issues in the Amazon. And they have written a letter to the Securities and Exchange Commission to investigate Chevron Corporation's lack of disclosure about the potential liabilities, or in other words, the amount of money that's at stake here from this lawsuit. An independent review of the damage done in the Amazon put the bill at $6.14 billion to clean it up.
And well, that's something, you know, that they're doing that. That's something that DuPont Shareholders for Fair Value has also done, send a letter to the SEC requesting disclosure. So the SEC has a mounting stack of these requests to demand that companies do better disclosure on these issues now.
And what is, from a lawyer's perspective, what is the requirement or obligation of a company to disclose such potential liabilities?
Well, there's a clear requirement in the law to disclose trends, events, and uncertainties that may pose material financial liabilities to a company. Those are legal hedge words in some degree, but it means disclose what investors would reasonably want to know. And I think in both of these instances, there's a lot of information that investors would want to know that's not been disclosed.
And disclosing it, there's really nothing preventing them from disclosing it. I mean, it's easy enough to say, oh, this is something that is actually really happening, correct?
That's right. In both instances, there were a lot of indicators early on that these could be big problems for these companies. And it's about time for the SEC to step up to the plate and investigate these kinds of charges and take some kind of enforcement action where it's appropriate.
Well, I think something else, another story that we had covered, Bhopal, so is it something's happening with that recently?
Well, 150 survivors of the 1984 Bhopal disaster in India have announced that they're going to march on foot from New Delhi on February 20th to the Union Carbide Company's headquarters in India to demand responses to all their demands for cleanup and for addressing the health needs of people in Bhopal. So that is continues to be an issue in the news as well.
Okay, and lastly, we talked about GE a while ago, and now we've got a shareholder activist who is filing a resolution asking GE to explain why it should be addressing climate change. This is sort of a flip on the usual kind of shareholder activism.
Yeah, what an issue. We should come back to it and look at it more closely in another show. It's really an amusing news story, actually, with this guy, Stephen Malloy, who receives a lot of funding from ExxonMobil, trying to tell GE not to pay attention to climate change.
Well, we'll have to save that for a future edition of Corporate Watchdog Radio.
Listeners receive our podcast and listen to archived versions of our show at corporatewatchdogmedia.org. Tune in again in 2 weeks.
We're also broadcasting on a number of radio stations around the country, and we actually just added one in Hamilton, Ontario. That's CFMU. And we have also added a podcast with Houston-based KPFT, which is one of five Pacifica flagship stations across the country.